Hi everyone, I'm Heidi Rogers, and this is Tell the Others. I wanted to create a place for meaningful conversation, life lessons, and parenting hacks. Sometimes I chat to interesting people, sometimes I answer questions about parenting or life stuff, and sometimes I just rant. These episodes are filled with stories and insights that made me say, ugh, I just have to tell the others. So let's dive in to hear what we can learn today. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tell the Others with me, Heidi Rogers. And today I'm joined by the lovely Tom. Now, I might say it wrong. I always say Ahern in my head, but I think you say Ahern. How do you pronounce it?
I say Ahern because that is the way to say it, I suppose. That's just the way I say it.
But I didn't realize that though, as I was about to say it, I was like, I think I say it wrong because you say it the way it is, not my way, but my head says. Yeah.
So yeah, it's all relative. Ahern is the way.
Probably best to say it the way that it is and not the way that my brain sees it. Tom is amazing, and I will let you intro all of the cool things about you. But yeah, why don't you just tell everyone a little bit about who you are, what you're into, blah, 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 all that good stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for this, Heidi. It's cool. I appreciate the compliment that I'm amazing. That's very nice. I suppose what I do, number one, now, primarily I would describe myself as a writer because that's what I love to do the most. I love writing about the nature of this unbelievable world that we live in, how other people have tried to figure all the basic fundamental life questions out and all that sort of stuff. So very philosophically based, love psychology, and then everything that is included in psychology, how individuals develop and mature and all of that stuff. I love the podcast. I love being a podcast host because I get to learn for free. And I work as a counselor. So that's kind of my job. But I really try hard to focus all of my attention on what I'm really interested in. And if people want to come along for the ride for that, despite how potentially boring it could be, then I'm very humbled.
Cool. That makes me think, what was one of your biggest learnings? Like, do you have a podcast guest or a podcast episode where you were like, oh, damn, that was hardcore. I feel like I learned PhD level information in that podcast. Like, you know, those conversations, I mean, I can think of conversations I've had with clients or with friends where you just leave like, whoa, you know, like your brain was just melted because you go, whoa, I've never thought about it that way or whatever. Do you have, cause you know, the name of the podcast being Tell the Others is all about like, what's the stuff you would want to tell the others. And you've talked to, how many podcast episodes have you done?
Oh, so not for the MindMate podcast, but I would have done over 400 shows probably about now. So,
dude, so that's 400 conversations with lots of amazing people. So yeah, your brain would have a lot of cool information in it. So yeah, what is one of your things that has come just from a podcast?
You know, I mean, God, it's such a, that is a question that I really need to have a think about because there have been so many. I think one thing that really comes to mind, I can't remember anything that he specifically said that resonated with me, but different perspectives is so fascinating. There's two actually. And you know, one of them, both of them are quite strange in their own cool way. One of them was Colonel Chris Hadfield, who's lived in space, I think for the longest amount of time, apart from any other human being. So, wow. And he became really famous because he did that David Bowie cover and he filmed it whilst he was actually up in space as well.
Yes, I remember seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got this lovely handlebar mustache and all that sort of stuff. But just being called, this is probably quite applicable given the times as well, being called into that state of reflectiveness where it's like just you looking at the pale blue dot, having a think about, you know, because we all look at life from where we are looking up at the stars, but he's up there looking down. And some of what he had to say, I think was really, really fascinating. I think it definitely made me think about how important it is to know my place. That's why I think I've tried to make it a nightly practice to look up at the stars every night, just to remind myself of perhaps the insufficiency or just insignificance of things that I'm really troubled by at that time. Like, oh, you know, I can't believe I did the dishes like that, or I can't believe Siobhan didn't. I'm like, hang on, just relax. You're a blob of meat just ramming through space and eventually you'll head back in there. And this is like a fun little holiday. So Are the dishes that important? Yes. But so that one was really cool. And the other one I thought was really cool was my friend and I, we interviewed a porn star, think she was of the hardcore variety. Wow. But listening to her talk about how much she enjoyed it, how much like meaning it actually brought her life and all of that cool stuff, because you have this very kind of one view idea of what a porn star is, and you know, maybe they didn't want to do it, but that was the only way they could make money, or and here she was saying all these incredibly liberating things like, I'm the woman, I'm in power, this is what I like to do, I'm paid way more than the men. Like, that was really, I just didn't expect that. You know, I thought we went into it open-minded and we didn't expect to have that depth of conversation. It was really liberating.
Isn't that interesting? I'd have to agree with you that sometimes those conversations you have with people where you're expecting it to go one way and then it goes completely different direction, and sort of goes back to what we were saying before about wanting to run interviews or conversations with people open-ended and not having a script or having questions written down, that, yeah, I think you leave room, I guess, for more organic stuff. Or why is it, what is that? That's, I guess it's letting it unfold and not letting your preconceived ideas or your judgments cloud. Cause yeah, if I was interviewing a porn star, I would have a whole list of questions that my judgments basically would have assessed and determined that these are the important things to ask. But yeah, then you get in there and you realize I know nothing and this is different than what I thought was important to talk about, I guess.
Yeah. And I think what's difficult about just listening to, as you're talking, I think what's difficult about listening is that you, to really be a good listener, which is something I'm struggling and slowly getting better at, I think, but it's always progress. But like, to be a good listener, you have to go into a conversation knowing that little parts of you are going to die. You know, those little judgments that hold and are the fabric and the glue of your ego are going to die. And to be willing to confront that when someone says something that changes your view of the world and yourself, like, it's tough because it's like, no, this is who I am. This is the way the world works. This makes sense to me. When someone says something like, you know, porn gives my life meaning and, you know, I feel very liberated from it, as one example, is just like, oh, well, then what does that mean about me? Just to a proportional degree. And I think that's really challenging, but it's also a lovely skill to acquire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listening is such an art form, isn't it? It's such a skill, and it's such a, I reckon a lot of people think that listening is something they're good at, or that they think is like, I don't know, like a standard thing that like, I know how to brush my teeth, and so I know how to be a good listener. And it's like, no. How would you explain it? Like, so if someone's listening and going, I think I'm a good listener. How do I know if I'm a good listener? Or what are the traits of a good listener? Like, what have you learned either through podcasts or through counseling other people? What makes a good listener? How is someone a good listener?
Yeah. And I think counseling has helped me so much with that, because it forces you to do that, because like, we live in a world of subjectivity. Everyone has their own different experience. And if you can't listen well in the therapy world, you're going to go into every specific session thinking that what worked for you will subsequently work for everyone. And that's so not true. And you learn that very quickly, or you don't have any money. So yeah, that's important to know. But I think what makes someone a good listener, maybe even a better question to ask, is like, how can you become a good listener? And what helped me in the beginning was like, what did I want out of the conversation? And I think when you identify as a learner, that implicitly states that you're willing to give up the parts of you that aren't willing to go along with whatever the other person who's saying, who actually might be an expert in their field. And that's what's so humbling about interviewing experts such as yourself, all these people. It's just like, they know a hell of a lot more than you. If you're not going to at least play around with that, then you're not going to get very far. So I think like, becoming a good listener, and that goes well with counseling in the therapeutic world as well. No one knows themselves better than themselves. Mm-hmm. So for you to say, oh, well, maybe you should do this, it's like, well, no, they shouldn't. You know, why would they do that? Like, why do you think they haven't tried doing that? Like, what's blocking them from doing that? They know themselves a hell of a lot better than you ever will, despite what they say. I think all of that stuff really helps as well. Carl Rogers in the 20th century spoke about this idea of listening. And one thing that really helped me with just with my, in my personal relationships as well, was that if I would find consistent disagreements or arguments presenting themselves or whatever, one thing that really helps me is to say to them what I think they were trying to say to me. Mm-hmm. And if I got that wrong, well, then obviously it's on me that I wasn't listening. And so then I want to be able to try to say back to them exactly where they're coming from, mm-hmm. so that at least my argument is based off their own merit, what they're saying. So that really helps as well, I suppose. But yeah.
Mirroring back what they say. Yeah. I always say to parents that I work with that that's probably one of my biggest tips for parents is if you're trying to connect better with your kids or you're trying to have less tantrums or less power struggles or whatever, just start mirroring back to them what they're saying. And that's such a quick way to get kids to feel heard, seen, validated. So you want to watch TV now? Is that what you're saying? You know, or you don't want to get your shoes on? Like just validating back, like, I heard you and I'll show you how I heard you because I'll say back to you what you just said to me. It's so simple. You're so right. It's so simple, but it's such a powerful way to get people to feel heard and seen by just mirroring back to them. Yeah.
And it helps you too as well, because we're so lost in our own heads. It's so important to validate people, like 100%. But then it's also so important that you actually have a more realistic scope of the world. And if you're missing what people are saying all the time, then you got some work to do. Like, what's going on in that head? But yeah, it's mirroring. That's so cool. Like, it's, yeah, it works on just both fronts perfectly.
Because you know how when you're talking to someone, I have friends like this, and I think we all have friends like this and family members and colleagues and whatever, that as you're talking to them, you're like, you're not listening. You're just waiting for your turn.
Yeah.
And I can see it. It's like, I can see it in your face. You're not even listening to what I'm saying. You're just waiting for that gap in my speech so that you can then interject with your whatever. And it's like, you could, you know, the last line I could say is, and then I murdered 20 people. And then you go, yeah. And so, and like, you're just completely, you know, like bulldoze and not even listen to what, like, dude, you didn't even listen to what I just said. Like, ah, that is so frustrating. That is so frustrating.
Actually, that's a really good point. Like, why do you think people do that though?
Ego, I think.
Yeah.
I think that, well, cause ego, I think, is all about why we say shit in the first place. You know, like, anytime when I'm in session with the client and my brain goes bing, like, oh, that makes me think of something, either a personal anecdote or a professional anecdote or research, or my brain goes with something I want to tell you and something I want to share with you, I run a quick filter. Why? Why do I want to say that? Because it makes me look good, makes me look smart, ego related somehow, that makes my ego feel awesome. Or it's going to help you, or help you unpack something, or help you see something clearer. I have to always run it through a filter, I think, before I'm going to say something with a client. I don't do that so much with my friends. Like with my friends and stuff, I'll blah, 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 talk, whatever. But with clients, I feel like it's your time, you know? So it's not my time to process my shit. Like, it's your time. But I think this is an interesting conversation though about ego, because I know you love ego work and you love talking about the ego just from content and stuff of yours that I've seen. Because I think that is a really good point to say, what relationship or what is that about? You know, like, okay, so if I say, so if someone's listening and goes, I don't even know what ego means, Heidi, I don't even know what you're talking about. So when I say, I'm thinking of one person in particular who does this every time I talk to her, she's just waiting to say her next line and not listening at all to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so one, I think it comes from ego, maybe a bit of insecurity. Maybe a bit of, I want to sound like I know what I'm talking about, maybe, which is ego. But yeah, I don't know. What would you say is, where do you think that comes from? Or what should we maybe do some ego 101? And we should maybe explain a little bit what we know about ego. Do you want to hit that off?
Yeah, sure. No, I think it is the ego. And I think it's good to explain what the ego is, because ego has been, Freudian ego has been, people think of the ego as inherently bad, you know, and it's just like, oh, you know, you got to check your ego. And sometimes you do. In fact, all the time you do need to check your ego. But at the same time, like, to exist, you need one. So we need some kind of identity. There are so many cool answers to the question, like, what is an ego? Some people say it's I am, what Rene Descartes said, I am, even though we said I think, therefore I am, which is not essentially true. I don't think so in any way, but it's the I am. It's the identity. It's the pilot of the vessel. It's the way you would identify yourself to the world, which is, I think, so that's why any word that comes after I am is so important. There's a Buddhist idea that I am who you think I am, which is really interesting because it makes you think about why you are the way you are, mm-hmm. and then what is influencing you to be that way, which is obviously very, very reflective. And it takes time to unpack those layers of awareness because it's scary because you've born into this world as a just potential, as nothing, totally dependent. And then eventually you get disciplined and socialized necessarily because otherwise you run across the street and you'd yell at people. And so we need all that stuff. And then you become one of the group at school and then you come out the other side and you shift. It's like, okay, you're done now. You're an adult. And then we're just left with these social attachments and conformities. And then there's no like high school and then tertiary education, but there's no like other that beyond education of, okay, well, how do we find the individual in you now that you have been socialized and disciplined necessarily because we want you to live and thrive? How do we find that other part that we perhaps lost as the kid, the creativity, the unique perspective, the part of you that makes you you, whether you would call it the soul or whatever you want to call it? We all have that inherent unique expression because we all see the world through a subjective lens, and to be able to give that to the world is, I think, the essence of what makes life meaningful. I don't think without that, that you're just a sheep, you know, or you're just an animal that lives and then dies. Like, how do we make this world meaningful? It's like, well, we can give our own unique expression to the good of the world or something like that. You know, I don't really know, but it's something like that. And I think when you're talking about the ego is just the identity of who you are, but we also want to make sure that who you are, just want to make sure that you know that who you are is influenced by all these other things, social desires, individual desires. So it's like becoming who you want to be, I think, is the way to be, attach yourself to a nice ego. I hope some of that makes sense. Trying to figure this out as I go along because it's so deep.
I think what you said a minute ago, well, two things. One, saying it's like it's malleable. It's something that you can tweak. It's not just because I'm sure you would hear this. I hear this a lot from clients. And I think this about myself sometimes. I'm really good at, and we all have these ego-based beliefs about ourselves or the world. All men are assholes. I'm not good with money. We have all of these just sayings that people throw out there, like, oh, this kid, he's so challenging. He's been a difficult kid his whole life. He came out difficult. He was a difficult baby. And now he's a difficult teenager. Like, people just have these labels that they just slap on themselves and on others, and races and genders and professions. That is all ego, isn't it? But what you said a second ago of, so I think you're right that it doesn't have to be that way. Like, it's all subjective. But then also you said that's why it's so important, statements that begin with I am, and then what follows that. Can you say a bit more about that? Because I think I learned that. Like, I didn't know, like, most of us, I don't think, come out knowing that. Like, I learned that in my early 20s that, like, oh, I decide. Right. I just thought there was things that I was and wasn't good at and believed or whatever. And I didn't realize that it was, malleable. So how did you get to that? Or how did you learn that? Or explain, can we unpack that a little bit more for people of what does the whole I am blank, why does it matter?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to give some background as to why a label sticks, because when you're dealing with semantics, I think it's like, it's all well and good to say that, and I write about this all the time, but the power of the label, and people are like, oh yeah, you know, labels mean something, but it's like, I don't think we know how much they actually guide our lives unconsciously. They're seriously, seriously powerful. And the reason for that is you are born again, to go back to what I was saying before, you're born into this world and you know nothing, and everything is novel and everything is exciting, yet simultaneously fucking scary because anything could kill you as well as anything could be like the elixir of your life or the philosopher's stone. You just don't know. That's why we need to explore the world. So we put things in our mouths and we're totally dependent on our parents because we need some kind of guiding light, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we put our hands close to the fire and that burns us. And I'm like, oh, okay, so that if I do that again, I know that that's the case. And we put bark in our mouths and okay, this is a tree. And so when we start to separate the world, so we separate our own consciousness from the unicity to now ego. So we develop an ego because we are seeing that we are separate to the world that we are perceiving. We make these unconscious judgments and suppositions based upon our exploration. So a tree won't hurt me unless, you know, like I saw in the movie, someone stands under it. So I start to get an idea of the way the world works. And obviously, because we're not separate from the world, we're living in the world, we also start to make unconscious perceptions about the way we are. And that can happen, you know, to very, very damaging potential, especially when we're young, you know, especially between the ages of 0 and 7, when our brain is so malleable and you can say something and, you know, when our ability to rationalize and analyze is barely forming, it's not even really formed. Mine only formed 2 years ago. So still forming, but you know, if someone hits you in the face or something, you can't separate the they had a bad day to they hit me in the face. So we start to believe sometimes that, oh, I must be a bad person. That's the way the world works. Now, if you take that idea, that judgment, that label with you as you develop in the world, that idea that I am dot, 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 a bad person, or I am dot, 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 deserve to be hit, or I am dot, 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 wonderful, the result of brilliant parenting, perhaps, that can really dictate your life because things will come at you and you'll have this unconscious idea that, well, are you either capable or you're not capable? So much of self-development as an adult is going back in and having a look at how you live your life. But for me, that happened traumatically, subjectively speaking, because I was dot, 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 a footballer. And when I was cut at the age of 21, so I had to separate myself from my ego and I didn't have a choice because I couldn't make the AFL. So I was no longer who I thought I was. And because I didn't know what I know now, that the ego or identity is malleable or that you actually can be someone else, I just went down the rabbit hole for 6 years. So I suppose what's been interesting for me for the up to from 21 to 27 has been learning about the mind, A, so that doesn't happen again, and B, so that I can help other people with it too, because it was my deepest pain. So it's also become my deepest sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that funny how that always happens, how our pain is what then becomes our purpose, eh?
Mm.
It's an interesting point you raise about identity, because that's ego, isn't it? Like I always say ego is like the voice in our head, or that's what it feels like to me. When I think of ego, I think of the voice in my head that says either I'm amazing or I'm shit and I suck. Mm. I'm like, it's the same person. And then who am I? The one who sees that. I'm the observer. You know, I observe that stuff, but it's always the ego is the, that shouldn't have happened. They shouldn't have done that. And I think it's a really interesting combo you just wove there of identity, ego, and pain. Because interestingly, ego is always involved with identity and always involved with pain and our suffering, isn't it? But that piece about what you just said about the identity you had as a footballer, that you were a footballer, I'm assuming from when you were, you know, 5 or whatever, whenever you start Auskick to up till 21 of like, this is who I am. This is what I'm good at. This is what I'm known for. This is what I always get pats on the back for is this. And then when that became not good enough, which I think is so fascinating with sport because and drama and performance and acting and stuff like that, where the rest of us who aren't in a performance-based job or passion, we're never told you're not good enough, right? Mm. But with sport and other things like dance or performance or acting or whatever, you literally are told you are not good enough. Like it is so harsh. It is so soul-destroying that you have been told for 21 years you're good at something, and probably too big fish little pond depending on where you're playing, you're like a gun, you know, you're like a legend in your town if you're in a little town or whatever, and then you progress up and then you realize oh shit, I'm not as great as I thought I was because I'm now competing against dudes who are twice my size or whatever. Can you say a little bit about what was that journey like to go from that identity formation and then at 21 to, I mean, literally told, I can't even imagine how devastating that is.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's interesting because, like, obviously when there are objective measurements when it comes to team sports or individual sports, because it's like you either make the finals or you don't make the finals. And it's like very clear that a team is either good enough or not good enough. But I think this is work where we could, you know, start to take psychology into the sports industry and have a think about saying to people, I mean, the difference between you're not good enough as opposed to this year you didn't play well enough or something like that is huge, is massive. But I mean, I look back on those experiences because obviously it doesn't have a go at your identity. It has a go more of like your performance or who you could be, which I think is really important because we do need some objectivity in this so that people can progress and have their ideals and really chase something, which is so cool. But for me anyway, it was because I was so attached to it, just like had the tunnel vision on for so long. And I think the big thing for me, because that happens to so many people all the time and people just move on, that's fine, you know. But for me, the reason why it shattered me so much was because me playing football was externally validated as opposed to someone playing football as an intrinsic thing. That's a big thing because I'll never be good enough now for anyone. So then I'm just a worthless piece of shit. And then that was when the transformation occurred over years, as opposed to someone being like, okay, cool. Well, you know, I enjoyed it because I enjoyed it. And I'm now a good football player because I just like to play it. I obviously love to play it, but it was also very much being driven by this need to be someone because I didn't feel, for whatever reason, like I was a someone myself. So I think that's an interesting little tangent there, I suppose. But look, the first couple of years were just distraction, trying to get out of my own head. I was very anxious. I had lots of obsessive compulsive disorder and panic attacks that were stirring from, I love this analogy, right? That was stirring from my childhood. So picture the ego was like a boat on the water. And I was just the captain of the boat. Now that I had no boat, I just was drowning and drowning and drowning. And because I was just overly reflective because I wasn't steering the ship anywhere, things were coming up from my childhood and I had no idea where these were coming from. Very intrusive thoughts related to my sexuality, related to this idea that I would develop schizophrenia and go crazy, this idea that I would go to hell. And I wasn't even that religious at 21. I'd been raised a Catholic, but I had this intrusive fear that I would burn eternally in hell. And the OCD came from, you know, me picking up rubbish all the time to prove to God that I was a good person. And all these strange things, like here I was just walking down this very fine path of AFL, AFL, AFL. And then, oh, okay, I can't be an AFL player anymore. And then within months, it's just like these kind of thoughts coming from out of nowhere, you know? So for years, it was just me trying to pick up the pieces with that. So very quickly, my ego ran away to CrossFit because it knew that the best way to get out of your head is to torture your body. And you've been doing that your whole life. So let's get back in there and do the CrossFit. You know, that works. It's so funny. I'm writing the second edition to my first book right now. And reading back even on that is just this, like in my first book, I wrote about how good CrossFit was to get out of my head every day. But looking on that book now, I'm like, that was just distracting myself. So that's really interesting to read back on that kind of line of writing. Yeah, the first couple of years was just trying to get out of my own head, try not to be anxious, try to medicate, jumped into drugs, all that sort of stuff. And then when I hurt my knee, that was the real, okay, Tom the athlete can't happen. So my partner and I moved to Bali. I became slightly psychotic if I was going to self-diagnose myself. Like I had very vivid dreams and I was hearing voices. Bali is also a very interesting place to live because it's so quiet and people there are very spiritual. So you get influenced by the culture. And I had lots of interesting kind of like hallucinations and things that were quite fascinating for me. But yeah, I suppose the transformation has just been picking up the pieces and trying to rebuild the ship with reading books and seeing people like yourself and things like that. So yeah, it's been a very challenging but meaningful time.
I think you raise a good point too about the whole numbing distraction avoidance thing that we all do, especially when we're like early in the work of wanting to run away from our pain, drink, drug, sex, shopping, Netflix, whatever, so that I don't have to acknowledge and look at my baggage and look at my shit. I think we all do that. But I think it's particularly hard for dudes because I think culturally, obviously I didn't grow up in Australia, but in America, the culture, and I know it's the same here, I've been here 14 years, but the culture for men is, it's not really okay to talk about how you feel. It's, at least in Australia, it's always, she'll be right, you know, and it's always...
That was good.
Yeah, oh, thanks. You, like, don't worry about it. Like, it's silly. And then dudes are always told from such a little age, don't cry, don't show how you really feel, you got to be tough, macho, all that crap. So now the fact that you're counseling and you work with men, I know you work with all genders and stuff, but like, I know that you do see a fair bit of dudes that, what are your thoughts on that? Because, or, I don't know, is this a conversation about toxic masculinity? Is this about normalizing mental health and stopping the stigma? Like, what do you reckon is the difference, the problem, the what we need to shift? Because if we were to go back in time and like take 21-year-old you going through all of this stuff, and we were to do it now, like with what you know now, how would a conversation with 2020 Tom look at having a conversation with 21-year-old you? What would you say differently to him about, you know, like, it's okay to cry? Like, yeah, what would you say differently? Or what, yeah, run with that. Where do we go with that?
Yeah, that is such a good question. My partner and I were actually trying to figure out where that idea that emotions are weak came from. I don't get it. I really, and I'm not saying that because I have some judgment about it. Like, I actually don't know where it came from. I'm interested whether it came from the differences between honorable and dishonorable discharges from war, because we didn't understand the difference between a physical injury and a psychological injury in the 20th century. But then obviously the psychoanalysts were very interested in emotions. You know, the father of psychoanalysis was inherently interested in emotions. So I really don't understand. I need to research it because it's so interesting. What one thing I would say about, at least what I've found with the differences between like men and women in the counseling world, is that there seems to be, whether it comes from sociocultural construct or whether there's like a biological underpinning with testosterone being rampant in men, there's this idea that's been really working, at least in my own experience, where helping men find another mission has been really, really good. Like finding a sense of, and we all need it. We all need a meaning and we need a purpose, but whether it's the words mission or purpose, this like idea of like becoming your own hero or something, it's really powerful to the guys I've been working with. And because that's a good question as well. Like, what would you say to your younger self? I think what I would have said to my younger self is let's build a boat at the same time whilst we're swimming in the unconscious waters, so that you don't just drown and lose all sense of self and everything is worthless and you're a crazy person. Let's give you a mission at the same time so that we can explore both worlds. So like, have your feet planted in routine and habits and exercise, and it could have been CrossFit. It doesn't have, like, sometimes we need little, you know, I say this technically, but sometimes we do need little distractions and things whilst we are dealing with the incredible uncertainty of exploring the self. So if you tie a rope to a really strong tree and then go out into the river and explore what you need to explore to find out what's working and what's not working, that would have been really helpful for me at the time, because I just went straight into the water and I drowned for like 6 years. So I think that's, if I could apply that advice practically, I think that would have been helpful.
And what I'm hearing too is self-compassion and having compassion, like what you just said then, is having self-compassion and like a grace or a generosity of you're working it out, and let's just give ourselves some patience here that it's, we're working it out. And you don't know, like, I love this saying, nobody starts off being excellent. Like, you have to get, everyone starts as a beginner in anything, and that's cooking, fixing your car, but also mental health and emotional well-being. You don't just nail it straight out of the gate. You learn, and you got to have, unfortunately, it's usually through adversity and through challenge that we learn the painful bits. What do you think is, how would you say to someone like to start? Because I think not everyone is going to have a, I'm 21 and my footy career comes crashing down moment, you know, like what, how do you encourage people to do that self-exploration? Like, I remember thinking that's like at different times of my life after I went through my first big like hell of my early 20s and like just so much pain and suffering and depression and stuff. I remember thinking for years after that, like, universe, what do a God, what do I have to do to not go through that again? Like, can I just learn, can I learn all the lessons now?
So that I don't update.
Yeah. Totally. Cause I don't want to experience pain. I don't want to, I know. What would you say to people that are like, well, I want to do this work. I want to learn. I want to grow. How do I do that? Where do I start if I want to figure that stuff out? Where do you tell people to go? I mean, I always say to people like, just follow the holistic psychologist on Instagram and that'll get you started. But like,
that'll help. That's pretty confronting.
But what do you say, or what would you do? Cause now you're like at this different place, right? Like, so you've had that first big piece of work that you've done of like, what, you know, mind opening, blinders off, right? Now, what do you do? What does one do to like continue to expand my learning outside of pain and suffering if possible?
Yeah. Well, I think your question's good because the analogy is like, I want to do all this work. I just don't know where to start. That's good because someone's already on the right path there. For a harder question to answer is, how do you get someone interested in this? Because then it's like, well, they're destined to fall over if they don't know themselves. So, and that's just inherent to human beings. Like, you can be the most incredible person in the world, but you don't know what's coming up and how you respond to what's coming up. And if you don't know your, all the things, you know, it can be a quite a painful trip, as it was for you and me, my friend. So yes, that the fact that already want to do the work, I think is good, but this is such a, this was like my expression. I don't think it's even my expression, but it was my little slogan for the podcast for so long. The best way to get to know yourself is to spend time with yourself. I just love it because it's so true. Just find out who you are. Like, go for a walk. Like, and don't take anything with you. And find out what you think of trees and what you think of birds and what you think of, and then because who you are is, your mind is kind of like a an inbox. And if you don't spend time sorting through all the emails and responding to people, and that's going to get pretty bloody clustered and busy in there. And we have to give ourselves time to sort through the inbox and go for a walk and sit down reflectively or journal or whatever it is. And slowly we move through all of the emails. And if you're doing that for the first time, you know, there's going to be emails in there from 10, 15 years ago, people being like, can you respond to me already, please? You know, analogous to childhood traumas or painful experiences and things like that. So giving yourself time to just be with yourself and learn about who you are and the way you see the world, why you see the world that way. My practice now, that's a really great way to start. And the tools that you can use are journaling, an open, honest conversation where you're willing to hear about constructive criticism, or you actually don't do this all the time and you should probably do that. Wow, that's interesting. Why do I not do that all the time? I thought I did. That kind of conversation is really good. Traveling is great for perspective, you know, all the usual ones, which are really good. I dream journal every morning. It's non-negotiable. I just have incredibly vivid dreams. I remember everything about them, 2-3 dreams a night. Sometimes they're very confronting, but that's also very cool because I'm like, oh, okay, I've missed that about myself. I need to do some work over there. So that's really good.
Have you trained yourself to remember your dreams? Like, is that a practice that someone could do? Because I don't remember
my
dreams every morning.
Yeah, it is. I mean, just having a dream journal, just starting to say to yourself that you're going to work hard to remember them can be really good. Having a dream journal by your side is a really good little marker. But then if they don't come to me straight away, then I'll close my eyes. And so what normally happens is, you know, Siobhan and I wake up and the dogs come running into the room. So obviously the dogs need to come to the room. That's fine. I need to give them, you know, good morning hugs. And then we'll just kind of relax. And then that's when I'll close my eyes and I'll just let the dreams kind of come back to me. Wow. And they'll eventually, and it is a training. You can actually train yourself to lucid dream as well. You can become conscious in the dream. So every time I see a red balloon, I'll remember that I'm dreaming, and I've had a few of those, which are really interesting because you can do whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah. I need to get better at them. And I don't really want to, like, I mean, I can right now, but my dreams are very, there's a lot of reoccurring symbols coming up, which are really fascinating to me because I'm like, okay, that's something that I need to continue to work on. Like my dream just last night, my friend was looking down on me over a balcony. I was looking up at him, and then there was this ball, just like a little dog ball. It had been thrown down by the forest, and I was walking down the forest. And as I was walking further and further down the forest, I was being filled with this fear. And to the right of me, there was this very sacred burial ground that was like possessed by demonic entities and things. And I didn't want to look there. And as soon as I got the ball, I ran away and I woke up. Now, to me, that makes a lot of sense based upon the dreams I've been having and based upon what my inherent fears are of exploring the self too far and finding these things.
Wow.
So it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I love to explore dreams because you can really, it's literally like taking a psychedelic every night.
Totally.
Yeah. So they're really good. That's just what I do. But I think like, yeah, spending time with yourself to get to know yourself is okay. The best way to answer that.
Mm. I fully agree, but devil's advocate and having so many clients that in our first session, it's just like amazing. You're here. Like, that is hard to get your ass on the couch and get to that first session. How do you encourage people to have the bravery to do that? Because I think a lot of people will say to me, oh, hell no, I'm not going to therapy, like friends of mine or whatever. Or like if I give a presentation and do a public speaking event, people might come up to me afterwards and they might say something that I'm like, therapy might be good for you, but you can kind of tell sometimes from people where they're like, I don't, that therapy's not for me. Like, I will not do that because I don't want to explore myself. I don't want to be alone with myself. I don't want to think. Like, and that's why I think quarantine and isolation and everything happening right now is so confronting for so many people, because they are forced with their own thoughts. They are alone with themselves for way longer than they would like. They can't go to the pub, go out to eat, distract themselves with friends, booze. I mean, you can still booze at home and stuff, but like, it's different. You can't just numb and avoid time with myself like I could pre-isolation. So what would you say to the person? Because I can hear some of my clients saying, I don't want to spend time alone with myself, you crazies. Like, that's ridiculous, especially childhood trauma people, because they'll say, we all have childhood trauma. We would all say like, I don't want to go there. I've actually have so many people say to me through the years, why would I want to open that can of worms? It's fine. I'm fine. My life is fine. If I do what you're saying, which is spend time with myself to reflect and how do I feel about trees, that's going to remind me of the time I was chained to a tree. That's going to remind me of the time that, you know, so how do we encourage, and it's easy. I think once you've done it and you've either done therapy or self-exploration, personal development, and you've come across to go, whoa, it's so much better on the side. Easy for us to say. But how do we sell it? How do we say to someone who's here and saying it's so much better over here, I promise you, just trust me. How do you sell that to someone of why? Why should I spend more time with myself and reflect on going for a walk without my phone? Why should I do that?
Yeah. And that's the fundamental question in life, you know, why? And what helped me was studying neuroscience, and I don't talk about neuroscience to my clients or anything, but when you're trying to motivate yourself or motivate someone, what really helped me was to know how human behavior is motivated. And it's motivated between two frames, getting away from pain and running toward pleasure. And they've studied that in rats, and it's inherent to the human animal. So the question why, to help someone explore themselves, which is really scary, there has to be a reason. Like, why do anything other than that? You know, so when someone says to me, because it comes up in my practice all the time as well, it's like, well, I don't really want to do that. Now, a lot of the work I do is around journaling and stuff like that. It's like, well, I don't really want to go down that path. They may not even say that. I think your point's really good. They might just say, I'm all good. And then like on the other side, you can be like, you can see the addiction, you can see the depression, you can see the distractions. Like, well, and we're all a work in progress, that's for sure. But like that person, everyone needs some kind of self-development mechanism. I really believe that because none of us are perfect and we never will be, but we can be better than who we were yesterday. So when you're talking about why pain and pleasure, this is something that I really love and I really use it. It's very confronting to, and this is why you have to know your client as well, but it's very confronting for someone to have a think about, what's the best way to say this? Why it's so necessary they do the work. Do you have any idea where this car is headed if you don't do that work? That's the pain I'm talking about. So it's like, do you know how bad your life could be in 2, 3, 4 years' time if you don't start now? That's confronting for someone, but that is motivative. Like fear is very, very motivational. If I am being chased by a lion, I will run faster than I ever have in my whole life. Fear is very motivational. So to give someone kind of like a very realistic future of who they could be if they don't do the work, that is very motivational. I'm not saying that's probably the best way to go about it in the beginning. And I think fear is actually more motivative than pleasure, but I'm not too sure. But the other side of that coin is pleasure. Imagine who you could be if you did do the work and then having a think and unpacking that. This is like getting to the root of someone's why. What could your relationship be like? You know, if you did just start to save $10, look how much money you have in 5 years' time. I'm not even including the compound interest. You know, like having a think about who they could be if they started doing the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very subjective and people respond. I've had clients that love the fear. They just want to jump into the pain. Oh my God, I can't believe I'll be like that in 5 years' time. I'm ready to go. And that works really well for them, you know. For some kind of bizarre reason, you know, the irony potentially being childhood experience, fear works best for them. But fear and pain and pleasure, I think, are really good. If you can apply them to someone's life to motivate them and just to motivate yourself to do things. Mm-hmm. I hate saving and, you know, I hate eating healthily. I really hate eating healthily, mm-hmm. but I really try to make sure that I'm aware of how important it is for me, given that I've had issues with allergies and asthma in the past and things. And I don't want to go down that road again. So I try to get all the good foods in.
Mm-hmm. And that's then your motivation is the pain that could happen if I don't engage in this pathway. It makes me think too, what you just mentioned a second ago about like different pathways to get to this point and journaling, therapy, but you mentioned earlier too, psychedelics and drugs in general. And I know you have a hell of a lot more experience with that than I do. So maybe share have you done ayahuasca?
I've not done ayahuasca. No. Okay. I'd love to.
Yeah.
I will at some point.
Well, let's have a podcast after that so we can
talk.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by it and fascinated by psychedelics in general, probably because I've never done them. So I find it just fascinating. But what could you share? And I guess, what is the difference? Because you've done EMDR, you've done therapy, you've done lots of personal development. What would you say is the best, safest? Because I'm sure we'd have people listening to this going, sweet, I'm just going to go get some mushrooms. These two professionals just said, I can do some mushrooms, spend some time with myself, and I'm sweet. Like,
yeah.
What would you say to someone about like, what's the best, safest, you know, what maybe whatever you feel comfortable to share of what you did get out of some of your, because I think you have one of them is in your first book, I think, where you talk about a very powerful trip that you had. Yeah. Go nuts.
Yeah. There was a couple of experiences on mushrooms in the first book, and MDMA ecstasy it features in the third book. And then EMDR with you is in my second book with breathwork and acid. So try to jump around all. I try to hit all bases.
Taking one.
Yeah. Exactly. And I haven't done psychedelics anywhere near as much as like the real psychonauts have. but I'd very much like to. And I think the biggest thing with any of this stuff, I would say if you're interested in starting out, and I'm not an expert, but I would start off with something that you can do that's endogenous. So it's in your own body. So EMDR and breath work, I think, are the best things to evoke that altered state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. To me, our session together on EMDR was no different to a 3 to 4 gram dose of mushrooms. Wasn't any different. And the fact that it was guided was very transformative, because you don't just want to go into a psychedelic trip and be like, oh, okay, here we go. I did that on about 10 to 12 grams of mushrooms when I was 18, and it ruined me. I didn't even know I was having that much, but we figured it out because the mushrooms were so heavy and potent, and they were being grown up north that we did it. And I was very unaware of myself. I'd been drinking that whole week on schoolies, and me and my mate did it just for a night out. And the first couple of hours were absolutely harrowing. I remember closing my eyes and falling down a void for eternity. And then at the very end, to find myself in a locked jail cell with my mum, 50 meters tall and wide, looking down at me with the eyes of shame that could only be seen by the devil. Like, it was shocking.
Oh my shocking. God.
Yeah, it wasn't. But again, at the other side of that, I learned a hell of a lot about myself, and that it needs to be guided. You know, the same idea of you need to tie your rope to the tree so that you can sift out into the water and explore. Without a strong foundation, it can ruin you. And I think that trip really led to a lot of the intrusive thoughts and things that came out when I lost my identity, because I had no means to distract myself from those things anymore. So they're like, here we go. And Carl Jung writes about how when you lose your future orientation, the riverbed of the past overflows into wakefulness. And that was the same idea. It was very congruent, because it was the same idea. Now that the walls were no longer like this and my perception of the world and of the self was a lot wider, everything that hadn't come up was overwhelming all the time. And it was bedridden for a lot, because it was just, I couldn't do anything. I was just like this all the time. Wow. But I think EMDR and breathwork are and if you have a good therapist like yourself, and I'm obviously biased, but like my partner as well with breathwork, someone who knows it back to front, can guide you safely. And when we say safely, we also mean guiding you through what you need to move through as well. Safe isn't, here we go, let me protect you. It's like, I'm going to hold your hand whilst you go through hell, you know, because it's necessary. It was incredibly transformative. And when we called the day after, my dreams were really interesting, because I hadn't had the altered ending to that story. I just had the same dream for years. And then with EMDR, there was an altered ending, like a Goosebumps book. So that was really cool.
Yeah.
But doing something that comes from your own body first. And then I think if you're interested, and what they're doing in the States now, where they're starting to train people to be psychedelic assisted therapists, is really cool, because God, I mean, that trip on MDMA was fascinating. Like, seeing all different aspects of my own consciousness, mediating and resolving conflict. And there was a young me being loved unconditionally by this love ball that would just hold me every time a manifestation of a past fear would come up. That was really interesting too, but it's also illegal. So
there's that.
There's exactly.
That. I always found it interesting when I read Steve Jobs' biography, the Walter Isaacson one, and lots of other prominent visionaries. Elon Musk, I think, was recently on Joe Rogan and sort of had a similar conversation about the benefits of psychedelics and just how acid, just like so many different things can come from it, of just expanding your consciousness, your awareness, creativity. You know, Steve Jobs was always nuts about how, you know, he said, you know, LSD wouldn't, if I hadn't have done LSD and so much of it, you know, a lot of the concepts and things I came up with, or the visions that I had for business or products or whatever, wouldn't be here without that stuff. I always think too of the movie with Bradley Cooper, Limitless, you know, where you just sort of go, what is there within our brains and our capacity and stuff that we don't even see, these rooms that we haven't unlocked in our own minds? And then the drugs help do that. Do you think that there is, like, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that when people say, like, it makes me more creative, or I wouldn't have had the success business-wise or creatively with my music or whatever if I hadn't done the drugs? What are your thoughts on that? Like,
yeah, it's a great question. And this goes back into the necessity for guidance, because we have painted in the contemporary world mind expansion as this inherently good thing. But, and this goes down to the most fundamental questions of life when you're talking about, and I'm going to take it there, but when you're talking about good and evil and all that sort of stuff, and how everyone, the similarities between like yourself and me and Hitler is that we're all human, which is not a nice thought, but it is true. And when people talk about, oh, you know, psychedelics have this incredible creative capacity and all this sort of stuff, the thing that I learned, I'd done mushrooms before and had some really cool experiences, but the thing that I learned when I had that really bad trip was that mind expansion isn't necessarily all good. In fact, for me, it was very, very, very bad, because I learned about things about myself that I did not want to learn. I didn't want to know that past experiences really, really negatively affected me. I didn't want to go back into that. I didn't even know I didn't even want to go back into that, but it was all there. And then this exploration of like the, how ashamed I felt of my life and how gross I thought I was and embarrassed and how, why I was, how much of a mess I was and how much of like, I was craving the love of my dad and being externally validated. And like that, that all, that was just like despicably painful to go into. So like, Limitless is a great movie because it's like you take this drug and all of a sudden you can do all these wonderful things. Psychedelics are kind of like that, but psychedelics, this is why the healing has to come first, I think, and it always has to happen, because like you learn things that you don't necessarily want to learn. That's like when you read a book or when you have an open conversation, like you might say something to me and I'll be like, oh, that means I've got to rethink like my whole perspective on that. And like, that's not fun. Change isn't always good. Change can be really tough, especially the changes that with something like a psychedelic shows you that you have to make. And that's really painful. So mind expansion is simultaneously good and bad. And you need to have some kind of, all the mythological tales spoke about the psychopomp, the guiding light, Virgil to Dante in Dante's Inferno, the thing that moved him through all the pain. What is the reason, the raison d'etre that's moving me through all this? Like, why am I doing all this for something? And whatever that light is for you, that should be enough to make you want to go through the pain so that you can come out the other end.
What is that for you? Because I think it's different for all of us, you know, the why. And those of us that are like pro therapy, pro self-exploration, like, okay to put ourselves in uncomfortable situations, have hard conversations. It's maybe easier for us to answer, like we don't shy away from that kind of stuff, but not everyone does. So I think I'm curious about that. Why do we, because it feels a bit sadistic in a way, doesn't it? Like I'm going to put myself through pain, or I'm going to go there. Because a lot of people go, no thanks. So yeah. What's that for you? Why go there? Why do that to yourself?
Yeah, well, now that I've had time to think about it, and Viktor Frankl said it could come from three areas. It was good deeds, challenge, so suffering, and then love. They were his three ideas, and he was obviously in the Nazi concentration camps. So he knew a fair bit about suffering. But what got him through there was the fact that he wanted to write the book that became one of the ones, Troubles, I can't remember what it is. It wasn't Man's Search for Meaning. But for me, I think it's love. I think I wrote a poem, and I haven't actually said it to my partner, but I wrote a poem called The Man You See. And I cried a lot when I wrote that, because I really felt it was very true. And I feel like when she looks at me, she sees like potential, or she sees like the very best that could be in me. Mm-hmm. And it's such a lovely thing, because I'm getting emotional just thinking about it. But having someone look at you and think about you could be, not that you could be so much better than you are, but you're doing well and you could be even better, is so motivational. And, you know, she doesn't just look at me like that, mm-hmm. obviously. We're normal, depending on what normal is. Yeah, but I really, really love that. And when I do all my writing, because I write 4 or 5 hours a day, so that's very meaningful for me as well, just to learn and write and express myself. But and there's like a suffering component to that, I suppose, because you have to sacrifice a social life to a degree, I suppose. But I think it is love that motivates me the most, because I've never felt so comfortable being who I am, knowing that I could say, do, or anything and come back home and the hug would be the same. So, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It's true, isn't it? Like that, knowing that you, in the eyes of someone, are enough just as you are, mm. and that they always believe the best in you. So like, even if you did something that hurt her or upset her, the lens that she would go into the situation with, her, you know, talking to you about, hey, you did this thing, it hurt my feelings or whatever, knowing that she goes into that with a lens of, I believe the best in you. I give you the benefit of the doubt. I know your heart. You're not a bad person. You weren't trying to hurt me. If you did, it was an oversight or, you know, an intentional byproduct of something else. That's powerful, because I think a lot of us aren't raised like that. I think a lot of us are raised very conditional parenting, very conditional love, and it, which I think is neat when we can kind of heal that wound or get that need met through our partners by having someone who believes the best in me rather than, yeah, or having an insanely high standard for me that I just can't reach, that I'm never good enough, you know, like,
It is, because it's like love. And also, one thing I try to say to people as well is like, and I love all different interpretations, but for me, the idea of the soulmate is very impractical. Like, it's just like, well, fuck. I mean, there are like 8 billion people out there. You want me to like travel to Norway and see if I can, excuse me, are you my soulmate? Are you my soulmate? Like, how long is that going to take? You know, for me, it's a very practical idea of find someone who's like a real babe and then show up every day. Great. That really works for me. So it's like, it's something that's cultivated, you know, but I think you're really right too, that coming to know someone that looks at you and just says, you know, you are enough. And also, you're enough happens to be something I really like, is really cool. Cause it's just like, you seem to really like me, even though I don't really like myself. Now, when you're doing all that reflective work, it's like, by definition, the way I interpret the world isn't the true way the world is. But to see someone like that, and I'm just thinking as I go here, which is something I like to do, but to see someone look at you like that is like, okay, why do you love me this much? Like, given that everything I know about the world is wrong, sorry, or isn't all the way the world is, like, there must be something I'm missing here. And yeah, I don't know. I'd like to read a bit more about that idea, but it seems to me like having a loving relationship, and like, obviously all the poets and things, all the romantics, they all talk about how love is all there is and all that sort of stuff and whatever, but it's definitely a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm. It is. I think sometimes too, that's a fundamental role that a therapist plays or a counselor plays.
Yeah.
I definitely have had that with clients where I'm the first person in their life that thinks they're awesome, or I'm the first person in their life that believes the best in them or believes you're a good person, because maybe the things that have happened to them make them think that they're not worthy and that they're filled with shame, or maybe the things that they've done. I know, like when I worked in prison, that was something I saw a lot, just that inherent, I'm bad, I'm not okay, I'm not enough stuff that I think sometimes in therapy, that's where it starts. And one of the kind of beautiful things that therapy, I think, is amazing for is the, just the relationship and not necessarily heaps of the personal epiphanies and self-exploration that you get out of it. Sometimes I think it's just the relationship of having another human being who sees me, hears me, and loves me, not despite my imperfections, but because of them. Like, have another human being who they've heard all of my stories. They've heard all of the horrible things I've done. They've heard all of the horrible things that have happened to me. And they still look at me with those loving eyes of like, you're amazing. And wow, I'm so inspired by you. And
how'd you get through that?
Yeah. And I love our time together. Like, I think so many times I've heard clients say like their brain was just blown by the fact that there was this other human being who would hear all of the horrible things they did. And it didn't change my opinion of them.
And absolutely.
Oh, it's so powerful. I think, especially for, we don't pick our family. And sometimes we don't pick our friends, you know, like the people who we're friends with up until 18 is kind of by circumstance of where we go to school and we don't have much control over it. But then later you can pick your friends. But I think for a long time, we are forced and surrounded by people that don't get us or whatever, that I think sometimes therapy or a counselor can be that for other people, that you can be that person who like loves you no matter what kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't think people are inherently bad. I've never met someone that's genuinely a bad person that chooses to be bad. Maybe some people choose to be bad, but it's actually because something really bad has happened to them and that's shaped their worldview. So, and I think, you know, when you're on my show, I think what you were speaking about, having done all that work in prison, couldn't be any more true because you've seen the extremes of what can happen to people. But being able to see that, this is why trauma informative work is so brilliant. It's so brilliant because it's just like, wow, people aren't bad people. People can sometimes become that way, but they're still trying to fight for some kind of thing. There's still a God in them that just can't find its way out under all the rubble of pain. And you really see that. That's not a woo-woo thing to say. Like, it's really true. And if they go into that stuff guided by a light of a therapist or someone that is like has done it before with other people and themselves as well, I think that's a big thing. Hopefully it can work out.
Because I was just thinking about when you said, I don't believe people are bad. I agree. I don't believe people are bad either. But there's a shitload of religions out there that believe it. I mean, what's one of the basic Christian tenets is we're all born sinners and we're all, and what's a sinner? Bad. And so I think so many religions, I mean, I can't speak of lots of other religions because I haven't, you know, studied them extensively, but I know at least with Christianity, you know, one of the core things is that we're bad and that we need to pray for forgiveness and we need to repent and that kind of stuff because we're just inherently bad. And I just find that so hard to wrap my head around. And I find it's so tricky, I think, to come from like the shame-based end of the spectrum that I am bad. Not what I did was bad or the behavior is not okay, but I am bad. Me, to start there, I'm just like, oh, damn. Like, you got a way to go, man. Like, you're starting literally at the hardest point of the spectrum that I think is total bullshit. I don't even think that's true. I think we're all born good and we're all born inherently kind and full of love. And I think that gets beat out of us in school and culture and environment and conditioning and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, what would you say to that? Cause like a lot of people don't believe we're born. A lot of people believe we're born bad.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, I just wrote about original sin in the book. So that's
cool.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very good question. Look, the religion stuff was a big thing for me, you know, because I was raised a Catholic, derivation of Christianity. And when, you know, my mental health declined, I developed that sincere belief that I would go to hell because I was a bad person. And I have no idea where that came from. I still haven't pinpointed the exact moment. Most of my other traumatic experiences I can remember the thing they came from. Mm-hmm. Whether it was just like a gradual indoctrination, it could have been that. But I moved into aggressive atheism and started, and I just fell in love with Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and, you know, loved their books and just felt, and I love the idea still today because it's critical thinking, which is good. You should be, you should think about everything that you believe to be true. That's why there's a tattoo here that is Latin for seek your own truth, nullius in verba. So I had to put that on there to never forget that. But, you know, what was so interesting was I read a quote later by a philosopher from the 18th century, and he said that religion is too iconic, too profound, too significant for so many people for it to all be ridiculous. And I think the other thing as well is to move from one side of fundamentalism to the other, you haven't really done a whole lot of insightful work there. You know, so I went from, okay, well, there is a God and all that sort of stuff, to there is no God, it's all bullshit, everyone that follows are fucking ridiculous. And like, okay, maybe both sides are wrong here, Tom, you being the manifestation of those. Let's go into the work here. So the second book I'm writing is about mythology and religion, you know, from a psychological perspective, because so much of it needs an update. And I'm not saying that I'm the one to do it. People have done it. Basically, when I talk about this book, it's just, I've just read people's interpretations that I really like, and I've extrapolated on their ideas. So I'm by no means doing anything here that's, you know, making the new wheel or whatever it is. But one of the ideas that, because I hated that idea of original sin, but one of the ideas behind it that kind of made me, I suppose, a little bit more forgiving or compassionate to that idea was I read the Old Testament, studied the Old Testament. And it was, again, completely through a psychological lens. It's not fundamentalism. I don't believe that any of this stuff historically happened. I think I don't even know if the people that wrote it believe that. It's just that people on either side of the extremities just take it because, and you can also be forgiving to them because, which is really hard to do, by the way, but to the degree that a belief system gives someone meaning, who would they be without their Christianity, given like how detrimental their worldview is to people. Yeah, I really want to try to do my best to see where people are coming from. Now, if one of them came and spoke to me, we'd be trying to do some work around that. But yeah,
I think I was raised Christian, but not super hardcore. Like we went to church on the weekends. And then I converted when I was 13 to an evangelical Christian church and then was hardcore into that through high school and then into college and then through the whole depression and all of that shit left the church because of how just learning more and kind of doing the bad, not okay things and then seeing how that was received. And then discovered Hitchens and Dawkins and stuff like that. And my brain was just like, whoa, there's this whole other world. And I love both of them so much. And all of their books have just literally had such an impact on my life. I'm with you on that. But I think this is maybe something for us to share with listeners is if you're curious about that, just watching some of their debates.
Yeah.
Oh my Lord. Watching some of their debates on YouTube changed my life. Like, because growing up, I think with church stuff and Bible stuff pumped into your head, the way that, because they're so smart and they're so much more researched on that stuff than I am, but to hear them explain why that's not possible or why this is how that could have been meant or how this could have been translated or whatever, it's just like, were those your first books that you kind of opened your brain for religious stuff or Christianity wise?
They were the books that I started to read. So there is some hypocrisy with them though, I suppose, because so like I went through the God delusion, God is not great. And then I really fell in love with Hitchens because he's just so provocative and it was really good. But when I was watching them debate, I started to skew back into the more compassionate side because here they are really extrapolating on all these ideas and looking at God and religion through a literal lens, and they're really opening up their critical faculties. But then when they debate with someone who is religious, they're so dismissive of it. And this goes back to what we spoke about in the first part of this conversation. Listening is the idea that you need to be open-minded. And I looked at that and I was like, well, what are they missing? How can someone believe this so much and then someone else believe this so much?
Yes.
And I think the issue that they do, and I still love them to bits, but they take on the side of an argument that a 10-year-old could take on. Mm. So when I was 10, or I think even earlier, I think my mum did the same thing. Is Santa real, mum? Is God real? That's the same question that they're doing. They just have all these evidence against the literal truth. Mm-hmm. And that's really good because it opens your mind up being like, oh, okay, who knows if Jesus was historically a person, you know, who knows if Abraham was or if Muhammad was or if, you know, all, who knows? But then Christian liberals, to speak about Christianity, take on the side of morality. It's like, well, what they stood for, okay. Well, that's really interesting then as well. But how do you explain original sin and all this sort of stuff? It's like, then you've got to go into the deep work. And I think if you can find a level of balance where it's like, we know it's not historically true. Everything you read is obviously culturally determined, and lots of people thought women were like that and gays thought like that. And we also thought that, I mean, we weren't anywhere near as smart as we were today. And childbearing was incredibly challenging and often came with death. Like, that's shocking. So when you read something like for a woman to have a child is incredibly suffering, it's just like, we have to remember how they lived their lives and saw the world. And when someone says, you know, oh, this is the way it is, it's like, no, it's not. It's the way it was for them, which is still bad. We're slowly moving away from that. But so one, you mentioned original sin as an example, and I hated that all the time. And then I started writing about it. And that idea of original sin comes directly after Adam and Eve ate the apple from the truth of the tree of the good and evil. Mm. And what I think that meant to me, and it's not just me from what I've read as well, is that when the veil is lifted and you can peer behind the curtain and the knowledge of good and evil manifests itself to you, akin to what I was saying when I had the psychedelic trip, is that you now know that you could be bad as well as the fact that you could be evil. So the original sin is, unless you're guided from the Christian perspective, because it is from the Christian perspective, unless you're guided by the spirit, the way, the truth, speaking the truth, you know, things that bring out the best in someone, the proclivity for you to be evil, I suppose, is much more significant. Mm-hmm. But again, even if I say that, that's taken me years to try to get to. The way I was taught it was that you're a bad person and you need to be baptized. And it's just like, damn. So this is why I'm so interested in mythology and stuff, because it's like, now that I've looked at the atheist perspective, now that I've looked at the psychological significance of the religious stories, it's like, it would be so wonderful that we could teach this stuff to kids. Because I also think it's good to know that, I mean, I could go out there and just kick my dog right now for barking. I don't want to do that because I want to be a good person. But to know that that kind of like ego thing in me exists is to be very mindful of it. And I think when you're very ignorant and you're very unconscious of the proclivity for you to be bad, that's when the unconscious projections come about. And they did for me as well. So kind of knowing that little, maybe it's why I'm a little bit more dictated to the pain to motivate me, but that stuff can kind of like, I think, be really helpful. But we need to teach it in a way that's modern and updated. You know, we don't see that.
Totally. I think it would be, God, so amazing if we could change the like curriculum for kids in school.
Absolutely.
That they could learn some of this stuff, or that they have as part of their core topics of math and science and stuff, that they learn social emotional well-being, or that they learn mindful. I mean, a lot of schools are doing mindfulness programs, but I feel like that's tip of the ice. It's great. Like, it is. I'm better than nothing, but like,
I'm with you.
Iceberg, yeah. Man. Like, there needs totally. To be an hour at least every day where we're teaching social emotional skills and awareness. And yeah, dude, totally.
Emotional skills. I mean, that's got to be everything. Like, you can talk about religion and mythology and morality, but like teaching a kid what anger feels like. Really, that's that what you're feeling right now? That's anger. What does it make you want to do? It's like, oh, what makes me want to do all these things? Like, wow, amazing. Now we can put that, we can filter that productively. But if we don't teach kids like what sadness and anger and pain feels like, all these things that we are going to experience, I mean, how do you expect any less of them to go through mental health issues and to, you know, do the worst things that human beings are capable of? They don't know what they're doing. We've been lying to our body ever since we were told that you don't need to be afraid of public speaking or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And anger, especially, I think that I'm actually working on, I'm doing a webinar in June on anger. And so I'm right now doing all the like research and reading about it and trying to sort my own anger out. And
yep.
little light work right there, just easy. Yeah. It'd only take me a week or so to just nail that one down.
Yeah, exactly. But
reading Thich Nhat Hanh, reading all sorts of Buddhist stuff, reading more contemporary stuff, Harriet Lerner, The Dance of Anger, reading all this other stuff to learn about anger. And it's fascinating that it's such a different emotion. It's so different than the rest of them. It's this one anger, like, and especially when you say in children, that triggers parents massively. And it's this really suppressed, shut down, go to your room till you sort out your attitude. Don't speak to me like that. It's such a fascinating emotion that you're right. Like, can you imagine if we had anger? You know, you say to a kid, so what are you studying?
Anger 101.
Yeah, what are you studying this semester? And they're like, oh, I have history, I have math, and I have biology and anger. And can you imagine if we're educating kids, just even like you said, teaching them like this is the word for what you're feeling, emotional literacy, you know, teaching them what your feelings are. But then also, yeah, so what? That now what do I do with it? Nobody knows. Adults don't even know. And why don't adults know? Because their parents didn't teach them. And so you look at all these kids that have anger issues or, you know, oppositional defiance disorder or behavioral issues. And it's like, dude, it's just because they have an emotion that no one has taught them how to manage. And that's because all the grownups, we don't know how to manage it. I certainly don't. Like, I'm a lot better than I used to be and better than probably the average, whatever that means, because I've spent so much time, money, and therapy reading into it to figure it out. But yeah. Like, it's such a skill. Like, and to say, like, I understand my anger and I know how to work with it, like, dude, that's far. Oh my God. That's like a lifelong journey. Like, to get that. It's not like, I don't know how to make a lasagna. You don't just like read an you know, recipe and then you just do it. Like, whoa,
so true.
Anger.
It's so, such so challenging.
Such a beast.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that helps me from context is to understand how we respond to novelty and uncertainty, fight or flight. When I'm angry, I try as hard as I can to override the mammalian brain and remind myself that I'm actually just afraid. Mm-hmm. So like if I get really angry at my partner or the dogs or something, I'm like, okay, hang on, I'm just afraid. I'm afraid. And that really humbles me because I'm like, oh, okay, fuck. Because my anger just wants to be like, listen, you know. But yeah, I seriously need that to take that 101 class.
I'll send you the link when it's done.
Yeah, please.
It's such an interesting one, anger. I'm very fascinated by it. And I'm very fascinated by it now when I see it come up in me or when I see it in my kids or when they trigger me. It's so interesting. When I'm in it, I'm not like, this is interesting. When I'm in it, I'm like, but.
Oh, yeah.
Reflecting on it, it's really interesting to look at because it has such a different perception. People respond differently than any other emotion. You know, even shame. Shame elicits a different response in us than anger does. Anger is just a completely different beast. But hey, thanks, dude. This was a fun chat. This was neat.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's neat to chat about all this stuff. So where can people find out more about you if they want to work with you in private practice, if they want to follow you? What's your jam?
My jam is just Tom Ahern, A-H-E-R-N. It's not O apostrophe Batman symbol Q. So that's me on all the socials. Putting a bit more work and effort into the podcast now because that's really my baby. I love the podcast. So The Mind Makes Podcasts. You can listen to our show together, mm-hmm. which is brilliant. For everyone that doesn't know, Heidi and I met in a professional setting first off, which is awesome. And we've become friends after that, which is a lovely addition. So yeah, but that's where you can find me, I suppose.
Cool. Well, thanks, man.
If you're a parent or a professional who works with children and you want my help in improving things with the kiddos in your life, or if you're simply a human being feeling kind of stuck and maybe kind of overwhelmed, my online programs have lots of resources, transformative content, one-on-one coaching, group coaching, and a supportive community. If you want to learn more, just go to HeidiRogers.com. All right, friends, thank you as always for tuning in today. Our time is our most precious asset, so I truly appreciate you sharing your time with me. I'll see you right back here for the next episode of Tell the Others.